Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the murky details surrounding who made the obscure film that is causing riots in the Muslim world that are likely to intensify after Friday prayers. Brian Levin, the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, joins us to discuss some of the tawdry characters behind the making and promotion of this anti-Muslim hate film, largely disseminated by Egypt's richest man, a Coptic Christian crony of the disgraced ex-dictator Mubarak. Then we'll examine the latest list of the most corrupt members of Congress just put out by the Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Crew's executive director, Melanie Sloan, joins us to run down this rogues gallery of crooked congressmen and senators that include three prominent Californians, Republicans Darrell Issa and Buck McKeon, and Democrat Laura Richardson. Then finally, we'll speak with Dalia Dasa-Kay, who is a visiting fellow at the Buerkle Center for International Relations at UCLA and the author of an article at CNN, How to Tackle Iran. We will discuss the IAEA's rebuke of Iran and the growing backlash inside Israel to Prime Minister Netanyahu's bellicosity, raising concerns that he's injecting himself into the U.S. elections to an extent that endangers enduring bonds between Israel and the United States. And joining us now is Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. He also was a New York City police officer in the Harlem and Washington Heights section of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're out there in the Inland Empire, and I take it for some time this character who's associated as a so-called consultant or a script consultant on this film that was made that got onto YouTube and has provoked these riots, which in part led to the death of four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador to Libya. And of course, as we speak, more demonstrations are going to be taking place across the Islamic world, an expectation of a million-person march in Cairo on Friday, and after Friday prayers, undoubtedly, there'll be a lot of violence around the world, all because of a few obscure people like Steve Klein. Tell us about this fellow.
Well, the first thing is, you know, they're still trying to find out exactly what had happened in Libya. It may have very well have been a coordinated attack that used these kind of protests as cover. But nevertheless, the basic point is that this reprehensible film has just resulted in an incendiary reaction throughout various countries in the Muslim world in the Middle East. And Mr. Klein, who works in the insurance brokerage business, is someone who's been out there for some time as part of the constellation of anti-Muslim commentators, although he's kind of a secondary player. He has protested a variety of things relating to Muslims in American life. He also actually had an interesting case in Orange County where he was putting anti-immigrant leaflets on windshields and successfully won a case that allowed him to do so under the First Amendment.
So tell us about this organization that he has, Courageous Christians United.
Well, that's one of them. I mean, there are a few. One is called Courageous Christians United, and that has been involved in protests. And he has a newer one called Concerned Citizens for the First Amendment, and that relates also to a book he did in the last couple of years, which basically argues that Islam is antithetical to the Constitution here in the United States. But he's also had membership or positions in other similar-sounding groups as well, and I don't know how much of the membership goes from one group to the next, but they all promote kind of the similar thing, which is basically that Islam is fundamentally in opposition to both Christianity as well as being a citizen here in the United States for most of the time anyway. He also has had a television show on something called The Way TV, which is a Christian television show that in part targets the Middle East, and he has had shows on there that discuss Islam. He's a former United States Marine, and he's part of a cadre of folks who believe that the United States will face an attack from the third jihad, and he wants to educate and defend the country against these perceived threats.
Well, he's creating a third jihad, he and Terry Jones and these other people, in the sense that, I mean, you're correct in saying that the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi might well have been using the outrage over this film as a pretext or a cover for an attack, and we don't know who they are, but they were highly organized and they were heavily armed. But there's still, the bottom line here is that Terry Jones, who's worked with Steve Kline and this alleged filmmaker, whoever he is, he actually got a phone call yesterday from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey, begging this cracker, this ignoramus down in Florida, to shut up and stop inflaming and spreading this poison. I mean, I find that incomprehensible that we have to resort to begging these nutcases to shut up and stop causing the deaths of Americans and other innocents abroad.
Look, your point is well taken in this respect. The fact that it appears that Libya might not be part of this web of outrage, we have a variety of countries from Yemen to Tunisia to Egypt to Iran where this has had an effect. And I think it puts forth a very interesting, though complex, issue. And that is, first of all, those of us who believe in free speech believe that even the most hateful and reprehensible speech out there, such as this, should be protected, and I'm on board with that. Holocaust denial, this kind of horrendous bigotry, the people who protest the deaths of our military heroes in the United States, we give them the right to do so. However, I do think that there is a moral and communal responsibility as opposed to a legal one. And I think Hillary Clinton addressed that today, where she labeled the film reprehensible. And I think while there might be limitations, and rightfully so, on banning free speech in the United States, and I am totally for freedom of speech, but what we must do is, where the legal limitations end, as a community, take a stand that says, this kind of discourse, while not subject to official sanction, should be subject to some kind of moral condemnation by the powers that be in our community. And that's something that our center has done quite a bit at Cal State San Bernardino. Islamophobia and interfaith relations has been our top priority, and we've hosted and also participated in these programs throughout Southern California. And I think that's something that we really should focus on. The answer to this kind of hateful speech is not prohibition, but rather a reasoned response that is an accurate one, that portrays Muslims and Islam in an appropriate context, which still allows room for dialogue and even debate without necessarily touching reprehensible, bigoted, hot-button, out-of-context vitriol.
But, Brian Levin, if you're talking about the only way to combat this stuff is a social sanction from people who find it repugnant and who will speak out against it, that suggests that Islamophobia has got to be recognized as hate speech in the way that anti-Semitism is recognized, prejudice and racist attacks against African Americans and Latinos and other minorities as they are recognized. Isn't that the problem? Is that for some reason or other we're not putting Islamophobia on the same level as anti-Semitism and other racist outbursts?
I think that's a very powerful point. I think many of us do put it up there with anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry, as it should be. But I do find that there is what Fareed Zakaria called a cottage hate industry here in the United States that attempts to delegitimize Islam as a faith. And what they do is they regard it as a homogenous, rigid, hateful political entity, as opposed to a diverse faith, which, like every other faith, has extremists, but also is really part of the Abrahamic tradition. And I think what we need to do is exactly what you say, and that is recognize that there is an attempt to hold out Islam as somehow separate and therefore an appropriate target of disdain and aggression, because it isn't quite a religion, and bigotry against Muslims is somehow justified. I think that's totally correct. And in many ways, as Hussein Ibish and I have written, Islamophobia resembles in many of the classic ways what anti-Semitism was 50 or 100 years ago. That is, that it's somehow indigenous to the people of the faith, that it's somehow incompatible with the cultures that the followers are in, and that it's part of a cancer that undermines a society. And if you listen to some of the statements that are made by today's modern Islamophobes, they really harken back to some of the most odious statements of anti-Semitism, not only from decades ago, but contemporary as well. And I think that is so correct, that Islamophobia must be recognized as a virulent form of bigotry that must be eradicated root and branch. And we can see this in many ways in society, how acceptable Islamophobia is, with the anti-mosque demonstrations or the push for anti-Sharia law or the way that the scriptures in the Quran are taken out of context, or the way that the Prophet Muhammad is degraded in ways that are just pure bigotry. And I salute you for giving me this opportunity, because what we have to recognize is that while there certainly are the stereotypical radical Salafists out there, they are not representative of the bulk of the over 1.5 billion Muslims throughout the world. And we have to make a greater effort in the United States to educate ourselves so that the Islamophobes will not fill that void with information that is either inaccurate or out of context.
Yeah, and of course, this Steve Klein fellow that we're talking about, who's associated with this film, he is known for, in Southern California, for his vocal opposition to the construction of a mosque in Temecula back in 2010. Again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, a criminologist, a civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Previously, he was associate director of the legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and was also a New York City police officer in Harlem and Washington Heights during the crack wars of the 1980s. Let's talk a little bit about who this mysterious filmmaker is. He told the Associated Press and the Wall Street Journal yesterday that his name was Sam Basili, that he was an Israeli, and that he raised $5 million from a group of Israeli and Jewish donors here in the Southland. It sounds like another case of blame it on the Jews. It turns out that the most likely person who this is, with the alias of Sam Basili, is Nakula Basili Nakula, a Coptic Christian. Now, what do we know about this guy?
Well, some interesting stuff. He apparently, if news reports are correct, misled many of the actors involved in the film, and he also had a conviction relating to bank fraud, if it is in fact the same person. And again, I want to be careful, because sometimes people have similar names. But as reported in the news media, if these allegations are correct, he's someone who is brazen in his views, and someone who has family back in Egypt. And also, if these allegations are correct, faced federal charges related to bank fraud, which also, incidentally, if the reports are true, says that he was not to access the Internet, which would make things very interesting if that's a condition of his post-release requirements.
No, he did do time, apparently. This and whether he's the same guy, there's an awful lot of coincidences that indicate that he is, and that he's been using this alias and pretending to be Jewish when he's a Coptic Christian. He specifically, according to Assistant U.S. Attorney here in Los Angeles, Jennifer Lee Williams, that Nakula was convicted for bank fraud using stolen identities and Social Security numbers and essentially kiting checks and withdrawing quickly from ATM machines on accounts that had no money. So, and he did time for that. Now, there is another Coptic Christian whose name came up here, Egyptian-born Coptic Christian, Morris Sadek. Does that name ring a bell?
Actually, no. Mm-hmm. Although what I would say is that there certainly has been some vigorous tension between the Coptic community in Egypt, which has faced discrimination and even murderous violence in both the south and the north of the country, which has produced a response by some here in the United States that has been in opposition to Muslims and Islam here in the United States. But again, I think this is an example where extremists are really the stereotype as opposed to the norm. Almost 10% of the Egyptian population are Coptic Christians, and while there has been tension, that's a community that's been there for many, many years, and there are vigorous efforts to create harmony between the two communities. But certainly, there has been an offshoot of the Coptic Christian community that has been in aggressive opposition to Muslims, as there has been an aggressive offshoot of Muslims who have been in aggressive opposition to the Copts. But I don't want to overplay this and have the extremists appear that they're setting the agenda for interfaith dialogue and relations.
Well, it does seem that Nakula Baseli Nakula, who's used a similar pseudonym before to Sam Baseli, that he is at least connected to this fellow Morris Sadek.
Oh, that we know. Yes,
Sadek,
that we know.
And he apparently helped promote the film. But the real person who promoted the film is Egypt's richest man, Naguib Sawaris, who is a Coptic Christian. He owns his own television network. And he's the guy that's been pushing this trailer on television and to the point now where YouTube have pulled it from Egyptian viewers. And it's had its effect. So you can see a kind of political agenda there to portray this Egypt as being run by Muslim fundamentalists. And of course, there is a response to it. As I say, the worst hasn't happened yet. Friday prayers are going to bring out all kinds of demonstrations around the world, and a million-person march in Cairo, apparently, is about to happen. So, again, it just seems like you've got your work cut out. You're trying to bring interfaith dialogue about, and then you've got these clowns out here trying to inflame sectarian tensions.
Look, and let me just say, one of the interesting things about the area that I'm in is that if you want to look at hate speech and hate video and television and the internet, every community is guilty. And what I mean is offshoots of every community are guilty. Look, in Egypt, they had on their television network a show called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which was an anti-Semitic treatise set into a mini-series. In Syria, we've had this on television. In Saudi Arabia, we had one of the chief clerics of Riyadh say, "My hatred for the United States shall last until stone liquefies and the universe collapses." By the same token, we have had Christian commentators, both here and elsewhere, make similar hateful statements. And, of course, there are offshoots within the Jewish community, such as Pam Geller, who make Islamophobic statements on their websites and elsewhere. So the one thing that I've noticed is that we have this all over the place, and particularly here in Southern California, where a fellow named Abdel Malik Ali went on campus and talked about minimizing the Holocaust and how the Shepherd Bird Hate Crime Act was a plot by Jews to limit the free speech of Muslims who criticize Israel. So, I mean, the one thing about being in this business as long as I've been in is I think there is a human tendency, not a particular faith tendency, to sometimes try and insult and degrade those who are different. And unfortunately, it's something that I see too often across the board. And what we have to do is whenever we see it, we must condemn it root and branch. And that's why, Ian, I so appreciate the opportunity for us to talk about this terrible scourge of Islamophobia, as well as other types of bigotry which take place. And all of the faiths that are out there, I can tell you, someone who tracks this, have extremists who are guilty of this horrible faith baiting that probably will go on for some time.
Well, just in closing, Brian Levin, it does seem that one thing that we can do, I think, is focus on is the people who fund these groups, like Robert Spencer, the blogger, that Breivik, the mass murderer in Norway, cited about 200 times. He's funded by David Horowitz and his organization, who in turn gets their money from Bradley Foundations and CORE and people like that. So these people ought to be, I think, tarred with the same brushes. They, you know, they're the ones that are funding this hateful stuff that's being propagated.
Spencer is one of the main Islamophobes here in the United States. But you know, let me say this in defense as someone who's actually conversed with these guys, and that is, I think that again the respect for the First Amendment is crucial, because a free society must allow hate speech. What we have to do is those of us who are people of goodwill must identify it and counter it and put together coalitions that respond to it. I don't think the legal mechanisms are the best way to do it. By the way, you know, many of these internet carriers are private entities and have terms of service which can be used to limit some of this. But I do think as a fundamental principle, it is very important for us to say that the government has no place in sanctioning this kind of conduct, punishing it, rather. But by the same token, Hillary Clinton and the president can lead the bully pulpit in condemning it, and educators and community leaders can educate people about the diversity of our faith-based community, as opposed to making First Amendment martyrs and giving them even more publicity than they deserve.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Brian Levin.
It is always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Previously, he served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and was a New York City police officer in Harlem and Washington Heights during the crack wars of the 1980s. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the latest list of the most corrupt members of Congress.
Scroll messages, victims and Christians both drinking blood, and they'll pray for the destruction of all hatred, more often just those with hate for us. Cause it hurts when you discover one's worse and one's better to suffer or cause others to. And you can live by your conscience. Now guilt is a concept, you know.
The elected are such willing partners. Look who's got all the tickets to the game. Development wants, development gets. It's official. Development wants his neighborhood gone, so the city just wants the same. Talking about
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Melanie Sloan, the Executive Director of the Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington and a nationally recognized expert on congressional ethics. Prior to starting CREW, she served as an Assistant United States Attorney in the District of Columbia, and prior to that, served as Minority Counsel for the House Judiciary Committee. She has been named one of Washington, D.C.'s top grassroots lobbyists by The Hill for 4 years running. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melanie Sloan.
Nice to be with you.
And this year's report on the list of the most corrupt members of Congress that you've put out, nationwide there are 13 Republicans and 7 Democratic House members and 2 Republican senators, Senator Vitter of Louisiana, Republican Louisiana, and Senator Mark Kirk, Republican of Illinois. I guess the ones that are grabbing the headlines here are the Californians, right? Daryl Issa, who is the chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, and Howard Buck McKeon, who's the Republican chair of the House Armed Services Committee, is he not?
Yes, he is.
So they're pretty, both of those are very, very high profile and important members of Congress. And on the Democratic side, we have the perennial Laura Richardson, right? She's been on your list two or three times before, hasn't she?
I think she's been on our list as long as she's been in Congress.
I see. So she's a slow learner, I take it.
I would say she's not a slow learner. She doesn't learn.
She doesn't
learn. And I think she won't be back with us for too much longer.
I see. Yeah, because she's being redistricted up against Janice Hahn, right?
Exactly.
So let's start with Daryl Issa, since he's someone who likes the limelight, apparently. At least that would seem to be the case. His case is pretty extraordinary, isn't it? Given that he did this sort of jihad against Eric Holder, the Attorney General, and eventually managed to have him, I think the first time in history, was it not, held in contempt by the Congress. Yet at the same time, it's the pot calling the kettle black, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. Daryl Issa, in June of 2012, wanted to include information that was found in a wiretap application, and he wanted that information out in the public, and it was a wiretap application in the Fast and Furious case. But the wiretap application was under seal, and that means it's a secret court document that can only be released under court order. But Daryl Issa wanted to release that information publicly, but he knew that if he did so, and if he gave it to a reporter, he could be prosecuted for contempt of court. So what he did was put it into the congressional record, and then directed a reporter to go find it in the congressional record. By putting it in the congressional record, Daryl Issa took advantage of a constitutional protection called the Speech or Debate Clause that prohibits members of Congress from being prosecuted for legislative acts. So he used the Speech and Debate Clause, wrapped himself in it, in order to protect himself from prosecution. And at the same time, Mr. Issa has been very tough on the other people who leak classified and secret government information. So it's really a case of he thinks it's okay to leak government information as long as it's in furtherance of his political purposes, but if someone else does it, they should go to jail.
And let's turn to Representative Howard Buck McKeon, who's the chair of the House Armed Services Committee, very powerful position. What's his ethical breach?
Buck McKeon has been involved in what is known as the Countrywide Mortgage Company's VIP program, and this program has gotten lots of press over the past few years, and a couple of senators, particularly former Senator Chris Dodd from Connecticut, had found himself in hot water over this. But basically, Mr. McKeon and others have gotten loans through the VIP program of Countrywide that are on better terms than other people would get them, and that's prohibited by House and Senate rules. You can't get gifts that other people can't get. Loans can, in fact, be gifts, and in this case, Mr. McKeon got a point reduced on his loan, and a bunch of fees were reduced, and documentation requirements were all waived on his behalf. And he claimed that he didn't know he was in the VIP program, but there was paperwork clearly stating that that it was through this program, and there's no way he didn't know.
And what's going on with his wife, who's running for the California Assembly? Did he not help her and use his staff to help her?
Yes, Mr. McKeon's wife, Patricia, ran in a primary for a California State Assembly seat, and in a memo outlining how the office should respond to the Countrywide revelations, Representative McKeon's communications director suggested conducting a background check into the relationships between Ms. McKeon's opponent and others, and it is completely inappropriate for a communications director that's paid for by taxpayer money to be doing campaign work, in any campaign work, but certainly not campaign work for the congressman's wife.
So let's turn to the only two senators on your list, Senator David Vitter, Republican of Louisiana, and Senator Mark Kirk, Republican of Illinois. Of course, we remember David Vitter from, I don't know whether it was called Hooker Gate, but I'm trying to remember what gate it was.
Could have been called that, right?
Could have been, because he apparently, David Vitter, had a predilection for prostitutes, particularly, and supposedly liked to wear diapers in his sessions with them. But somehow he survived that. And I recall an extraordinary press conference where his wife showed up to defend him, sort of wearing a sexy dress. The whole thing is pretty surreal. But there he is, still in the United States Senate. And what's he done?
Back in 2011, Senator Vitter sent a letter to the Secretary of the Department of the Interior, Ken Salazar, saying that he was going to block the Secretary's pay increase unless the Department of Interior began issuing permits for new deepwater exploratory wells. And this was clearly bribery. You cannot hold tie official action to anything financial. And here it was, Senator Vitter was saying, I'm going to hold your pay raise from you unless you do what I want. So in March of this year, the Senate Ethics Committee said that Senator Vitter had, in fact, acted inappropriately, but said it didn't. The committee didn't take further action because it hadn't made it clear enough that trying to bribe a cabinet secretary was against the rules. And so they let Senator Vitter skate by, but Senator Vitter said he was going to continue to do the exact same thing and will place a hold against Senator Salazar's pay increases in the future. So we'll have to see what happens next time he does it.
But surely the focus should have equally been on what it was that he was forcing Salazar to do, which is to have more less oversight over what happened with the BP blowout. Isn't that what's inherent in this?
Well, certainly that is a big part of it, but Senator Vitter is from Louisiana, a state with a lot of deep water drilling, obviously, as that's where the big accident occurred. And he is within his rights to have a position on that and to insist to tell the secretary that he wants more deep water drilling permits. But by the same time, what he can't do is try and basically extort the secretary. And Senator Salazar, his pay has been lower than other secretaries, and it was just a sort of a matter of form that they needed to pass through his pay increase. But as soon as this whole thing came out, Senator Salazar said, wrote a letter to Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, and Senator Mitch McConnell, the Minority Leader, and said, you know what, never mind about my pay increase. Obviously, I'm not going to play this game.
So has it been resolved?
It has not been resolved. He still doesn't have the pay increase, and Senator Vitter is still threatening to withhold any pay increase should they try to bring it up. So far, they haven't brought it up again. I hope they actually bring it up again so that Senator Vitter can, in fact, exercise his option to withhold it, and then the Senate Ethics Committee can finally take him on for it.
And what has Senator Mark Kirk, Republican of Illinois, done?
Senator Mark Kirk's problems really have all surfaced because of a nasty divorce with his ex-wife, and she revealed that Mr. Kirk had used his campaign funds to pay his girlfriend a substantial amount of money, and you are prohibited from using your campaign funds for personal use. So while he certainly was entitled to pay his girlfriend for actual work done, she would have had to been paid the fair market value for her services. And it appears that Senator Kirk paid both his girlfriend and, in fact, also his ex-wife at a different period, paid them both just to keep them happy rather than for any actual work they were doing.
So it's a case of hell hath no fury?
Certainly it's never smart to be both corrupt and mean, because somebody's going to take you on. And that's what happened to Laura Richardson, too. She was corrupt, and then she was also very vicious, and so everything came out. So you really can do one or the other.
So in terms of scale here, it seems like a lot of this stuff is sort of petty and penny ante, giving enormous amounts of money that Congress people raise on a daily basis. I understand to retain your Senate seat, you've got to raise a minimum of like $10 million, and to retain your House seat, you've got to raise a minimum of at least $1 million. I may even be off on those figures because they go up every year. So they spend an awful lot of time basically raising money and doing political favors in a kind of gray netherworld that's legal. So why do they resort to these kind of petty chiseling that goes on here, at least in some of the cases that you just outlined?
Yeah, some of these things are petty, and let me just say there are other members in the of Congress who are on the list this year who have committed far more serious crimes, federal crimes that they may well find themselves going to jail for. But I think one of the things that we often find is that members of Congress are often willing to sell out for very small amounts of money, and it doesn't take a lot. Obviously, these are just the problems we know about, of course, ever since Citizens United, with the huge amounts of money that are flowing through our political system. We really have no idea what members of Congress are promising to do for support of their reelections by super PACs and other kinds of more secretive organizations. So there may well be bigger scandals. They're just not out there yet. But even the ones we can find, it's just the kind of thing that the public finds itself so disheartened by, that members of Congress are often willing to use their positions to financially benefit themselves and their family members and their friends at the expense of regular Americans. And really, it's this low-level corruption that I think so increases the cynicism of the American public about members of Congress.
It also tells you a lot about them, too, doesn't it?
It does. It tells you that they're cheap to buy. It doesn't cost a lot.
Right. Well, tell me about, you just hit on something that got my attention. You saying that there are other people on these lists here that are much, much worse and maybe facing criminal charges?
Yeah, there's a New York member of Congress named Greg Meeks who got a sweetheart deal on a house and has long been under federal investigation. He also had a $40,000 loan from a businessman that really seemed to be a gift that he later called a loan. There is another two members of Congress from Florida who are under criminal investigation, one of whom was involved in a straw contribution scheme, the other of whom put up a shadow candidate in the Democratic primary and financed that candidate and helped try and defeat the leading Democratic candidate, and that's under criminal investigation. So there's a lot of things going on in Congress. A Democrat from New Jersey who basically used his campaign funds for more than $200,000 of personal expenses. So we have a lot of, there's a big variety of the kind of things people do.
Well, yeah, Greg Meeks is a Democrat, right?
Greg Meeks is a Democrat. He's the New York congressman who is under federal criminal investigation over the a sweetheart deal in the House and an improper loan, as well as some fake charities that he may have been involved with.
And who was the Florida?
The two different Florida congressmen are Vern Buchanan from the Sarasota area. He's the one who was involved in the straw contribution scheme. And David Rivera, who's from the Miami area, who's really been on the front page of the Miami Herald almost every day since late August when his scheme to insert a shadow candidate into the Democratic primary first came to light.
Well, just in closing, Melanie Sloan, you mentioned public outrage and the need for it. I mean, there is a kind of fatigue with Washington, and there's this assumption, oh, they're all corrupt, and there's no difference between the two of them. And I wonder what it is. We have tremendous, in this year, we have tremendous voter suppression going on, which gets to the very heart of democracy itself, and I don't detect a lot of outrage about that. What do you think it is? Fatigue, or why? Why aren't we more angry at what's going on?
I think it is fatigue, and I think people are also very consumed by their personal issues, and they view Congress as unwilling or unable to step into the void and fix the problems that affect real people in the United States. But to some respect, we get the government we deserve, and we need to, as American citizens, pay more attention and insist that our politicians do a better job and not allow ourselves to be palmed off with platitudes and fake solutions. We need to pay attention and demand more from our government officials.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Melanie Sloan.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Melanie Sloan, who's Executive Director of the Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington and a nationally recognized expert on congressional ethics. Prior to starting CREW, she served as an assistant United States attorney for the District of Columbia and prior to that served as minority counsel for the House Judiciary Committee. She has been named one of Washington, D.C.'s top grassroots lobbyists by the Hill for 4 years running. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back getting an update on the possibility of an Israeli strike against Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dalia Dasa-Kay, who's a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation and a visiting fellow at the UCLA Berkeley Center for International Relations. She's the author of Talking to the Enemy, Track 2 Diplomacy in the Middle East and South Asia, and Beyond the Handshake, Multilateral Cooperation in the Arab-Israeli Peace Process. She has an article at CNN, How to Tackle Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dalia Dasa-Kay.
Thank you.
And you're joining this long and somewhat heated debate that's going on, particularly in the Israeli press. I've been talking to a number of people. I talked to Colin Powell's former chief of staff, Colonel Wilkerson, the other day. He suggested that the most likely scenario for an Israeli strike on Iran wasn't the conventional wisdom is that Netanyahu wants to help out his friend Romney, but rather that Netanyahu's come to the conclusion that Obama's going to win, and by attacking Iran prior to the election and giving Obama a boost, he'll essentially co-opt him and own him, and Obama will be locked into an Israeli policy, which apparently the administration is quite reluctant to participate in. So does that scenario make sense to you?
Well, it's not clear, and I think that there's a real danger of politicizing the Iran issue, and especially in terms of injecting it into the American election cycle. But certainly there's a lot of theories out there. That's one of them. It's really hard to know what the Prime Minister of Israel's motivations are, but there's no question that the timing of this is leading to speculation that there is some domestic context. Whether it's to lock the Obama administration into support for an attack or not is unclear. What is clear is that the U.S. administration is most definitely concerned about an Israeli attack, whether it happens before or after the election, because it feels it would be very destabilizing for the region at large. And in terms of the Israeli domestic scene, I think there's especially a lot of concern about an Israeli attack, which is why I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu, while I think he's serious, may not have as much freedom of action to decide when and where he exactly will attack, because there's a lot of resistance within the Israeli security establishment about a military strike against Iran.
Well, apparently there's growing resistance, particularly in the Knesset. Shaul Mofaz, the opposition leader in the Israeli parliament, attacked Netanyahu and said, asked rhetorically, which administration is more important for you to replace, the administration in Washington or that in Tehran? Explain to me, Mr. Prime Minister, what are your red lines in managing the current crisis with America over Iran? And we know that somebody leaked the notion that Obama had rebuffed Netanyahu's call for a meeting, which, of course, the Romney team seized on, and it turned out that that was not true. So when you're talking about this being injected into the U.S. politics, that is apparently what's got a lot of people like the opposition leader in Israel worried, haven't it, that they consider the U.S.-Israeli relationship more important than and something that could be compromised by interfering in an American election.
Absolutely. And I think that is why you are hearing more discussion in Israel and concern about this issue getting politicized, whether it's intentional or not by Prime Minister Netanyahu. That's the result. And so I think a lot of Israelis are concerned that that the relationship with the U.S. could be jeopardized over this. I think most Israelis believe that the U.S. would ultimately, whoever's the president, would support Israel. But I think, you know, the bigger question is, you know, what is the best way to stop the Iranian nuclear program and its progress? And I think that there are a lot of voices suggesting this needs serious debate. There was actually a report that just came out in Washington today by some very serious former U.S. Generals and senior officials, really giving some pause to the notion that even a U.S. military strike would effectively stop this program. It would at best delay it. And so I think, you know, Israelis understand this. They've had their own debates on this. And, you know, whether the timing before the election is the right time, it's really a question of what will best stop or slow this program. And it's very unclear that Israel would get U.S. or international support at this juncture, when, while there's very worrying reports about Iranian nuclear
progress, it's very important to keep in mind that Iran does not yet have a nuclear weapon. And I think your listeners really need to make sure that everyone understands that, of course, it's a very worrisome development. The IAEA just came out rebuking Iran and should continue to do that over its enrichment capabilities. But it does not yet have a nuclear weapon. And so I think, you know, we need to put all of this political discussion in that context of really focusing on that the serious objective of trying to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran.
And indeed, the IAEA report that you just referenced, Dahlia, was pretty unanimous. 31 out of the 35 member states voted in favor of a resolution expressing serious concern about Tehran's refusal to suspend uranium enrichment. The only country to oppose the measure was Cuba. Now, again, I'm speaking with Dahlia Dasakay, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation and a visiting fellow at the UCLA Berkeley Center for International Relations. She's the author of Talking to the Enemy, Track 2 Diplomacy in the Middle East and South Asia, and Beyond the Handshake, Multilateral Cooperation in the Arab-Israeli Peace Process. She also has an article at CNN, How to Tackle Iran. Tell us more about the report that you referenced that senior military and diplomatic U.S. officials have weighed in on. I haven't seen that report.
Yeah, it's a pretty serious report, essentially looking at a cost-benefit analysis of a military attack, a U.S. military attack that they consider an Israeli attack to a lesser extent. And it doesn't come to any firm conclusions one way or the other, but it really kind of lays the ground of what would be the risks and opportunities in this kind of option. And what it essentially suggests is that even with superior U.S. military capabilities, and this whole Israeli-U.S. debate is all about, largely about the question of getting the U.S. to take a more hardline stance or a more unequivocal stance supporting military options. So this is really turning the discussion to this question of a U.S. strike, not just an Israeli strike. And this report is suggesting that even with superior U.S. military capabilities, the U.S. could certainly delay an Iranian program longer than an Israeli strike could do. But it ultimately could not stop an Iranian nuclear weapons program in the longer term without essentially a commitment of serious ground forces, if the objective is ultimately to be absolutely certain the program can't get reconstituted at a later stage. After all, it's very difficult to bomb technological expertise, which Iran has, and that is something that is not going to go away even after a military strike. And the report and other analyses on this issue have suggested that, in fact, a military strike, whether it's the U.S. or Israel, will actually just make the Iranians more motivated to weaponize their program to deter further attacks like this in the future. So it raises a lot of concern, and it's written by serious military analysts and others, and should give some pause to those, you know, weighing this option. And I think, will kind of reflects the mood in the U.S. official circles and strategic circles about this being a very, very difficult option. And which is why I think the administration, it's not a political issue, but it's also a judgment of making sure the United States weighs all its options and really exhaust all its other options in terms of trying to prevent this program before resorting to this very serious and consequential option of a military strike.
So perhaps Obama's little quip about Romney jumping the gun in terms of criticism of the sacking of the embassy in Cairo applies here. Shoot first and aim later.
Political, but I mean, there is a sense, and it's not just coming from Governor Romney in terms of the critique of President Obama not being tough enough on Iran and so forth. There are other corners and that are arguing this as well. But I think there is an argument that this is a very, very serious national security issue that should not be politicized. This has too many major consequences for the future of U.S. national security, regional stability, and so forth. And I think there's bipartisan support among serious people. And this report was bipartisan. And it does suggest that before you start making this, turning this into a political football, which unfortunately is what it's becoming, that you need to really remove this out of the political context. And I think, we'll see how this election evolves, but I think there's more and more understanding that this might not be the best issue to be confronting the Obama administration on. So we'll see how it plays out, but I think there's you're hearing from Republican circles some concern about politicizing these kinds of issues.
So, Dalia Desiké, most intelligence agencies, from what I understand, and particularly the United States, do not believe that Iran has a bomb and is some way from getting a bomb. That, of course, is a big open question. They're apparently, though, according to this IAEA report rebuking Tehran, there's an acknowledgement that they are moving fast to enrich uranium up to 20%, and the stage to take it up to weaponized grade is not a particularly big leap from that. So what do you think's going on? On the one hand, the Ayatollah in charge of this theocracy has said, and he's the absolute leader from my understanding, he's basically said it's un-Islamic to have the bomb and we're not going to do that. But at the same time, they seem to be hedging their bets, making enough fuel or getting enough fuel ready so that they could go to that step. So what would change that calculus, or what is that calculus?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it's very hard to really understand Iranian motivations and get inside what this regime is thinking. But I think that you're suggesting that this is a hedging strategy is probably closer to the truth than anything. And it appears that, you know, it's not clear that this government is interested in a weaponized program, or for that matter, any Iranian government. But it is clear that Iran does see strategic value in having a potential nuclear capability that can later be weaponized if necessary. And so it seems that that is the direction they're going, just getting to the threshold point where they can have enough enrichment capability, as you suggest, at the 20% level, which is the serious concern right now of the international community, because it can be reprocessed and enriched much more quickly into bomb-grade material. So that is where the focus is, and I think there is a kind of wide growing consensus that that is what the Iranians are going for. And ultimately, I think what would, you know, change the calculus is probably, and I think the contours of a deal were starting to become, starting to form in the P5+1 negotiations that have been going on, which is that Iran ultimately would like some recognition of its right to produce or indigenously enrich uranium on its own soil. But what would have to happen is they'd have to see some advantages for giving up the ability to enrich at higher levels. And, of course, what they're really looking for is sanctions relief and some recognition of the program. So a final deal would probably look something like making sure that their enrichment capabilities were capped at a low enough level and were intrusively inspected to an extent that the international community would have confidence that they would know if Iran was changing course and moving toward weaponization, and then other options could open up. So I think that that's the contours of a deal are getting pretty clear. It's a question of the political constraints on both sides allowing that kind of deal to happen, which are pretty significant and in an election year, pretty unlikely.
So as painful and torturous as this negotiation track has been, if there were a military attack on Iran, then all bets would be off, right? And then there would be a real, as you pointed out, there'd be a real incentive for the Iranians to go for broke, wouldn't they, in terms of getting a weapon?
Yeah, that is the real concern that a lot of people who have expressed caution about a military option suggest, which is that, you know, if there's a bombing campaign on Iran, obviously they're not going to be sitting at the negotiating table anymore. They may be more motivated to weaponize. At that point, you lose the capability of the IAEA, which you presume would be out of the country during a military campaign, kicked out. You really lose all ability to inspect, and that's the best way we have to really know. Of course, there's satellite imagery and the like, but that's the best way of having people on the ground to really know what's going on. And the other, you know, longer-term concern, not an immediate issue of a strike, but longer-term issue, which would be that if it was done in a unilateral way without international support, something that provoked an international response, which would be a different situation, but if it's done unilaterally by either the U.S. or Israel, that there's concern this would erode the really very difficult and painful development of a coalition, really putting pressure on Iran and focusing on its violations of its commitments and so forth. And so the concern is that that erosion of that international pressure combined with increased Iranian motivation to move toward a weaponized program, because at that point they have very little to lose. You know, the combination of that would be pretty devastating in terms of really being able to prevent an Iranian bomb down the road. So I think that's why there's a lot of focus now on other options, as difficult and as limited as they may be, in trying to slow the program and reach some kind of negotiated settlement. It's not going to be perfect, but something that would be short of war.
Well, just in closing, Dalia Dasakay, the idea, though, that we're talking about what might happen in terms of a military strike that would then take off any restraints Iran has to go towards a bomb. The immediate consequences that seem to worry most people are that Iran could simply retaliate by closing the Straits of Hormuz and in many ways creating a global recession / depression. That's presumably why countries like China have joined the P5+1 to weigh in on preventing such a response. So isn't that the real sword of Damocles here?
Well, that is. I mean, that is a very near-term danger, and I think, I honestly, though, I think there's a lot of people who were a bit suspicious that or skeptical that the Iranians would really resort to that. They certainly have capabilities to do so, but it would also be self-defeating because, obviously, they're so dependent on that strait themselves for moving their resources out. But, you know, obviously that is a concern, and the U.S. military is exercising and doing many drills and preparation for that kind of contingency, along with other very dangerous contingencies that worry security analysts, you know, and including Iranians' ability to retaliate with their significant missile capabilities against Israel, against GCC allies in the Gulf, against U.S. military forces positioned in the Gulf, and then, of course, the Iranian lever of international terrorism, which could increase in the aftermath of a strike. So those are definitely the issues that planners are grappling with, and I think are giving pause to many, including many in Israel, which is why much of the Israeli security establishment is hesitant about a military strike because of all these very serious near-term risks.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dalia Dasakay.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dalia Dasakay, who's a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation and a visiting fellow at the UCLA Berkeley Center for International Relations. She's the author of Talking to the Enemy, Track 2 Diplomacy in the Middle East and South Asia, and Beyond the Handshake, Multilateral Cooperation in the Arab-Israeli Peace Process. And she also has an article at CNN, How to Tackle Iran. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.